Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast for Connecting Faith. You can hear the show each Monday through Thursday at noon Central. And remember, there are even more shows available on our website, myfaithradio.com.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Well, thanks for joining me on Connecting Faith today. I'm excited to introduce my guest who is, he used to be a serial quitter, and we'll find out about that in a while. But John Acuff has been writing a blog for some time, and out of that, his own life and experience has come a pretty interesting book called Stuff Christians Like. And it's, in fact, you can find out more about it on the website stuffchristianslike.net. This is one of those books that, in a fun way, does a little skewing of the, I guess, the evangelical subculture, probably. And John is on the Northwestern campus, actually, talking to the students, and so we thought we'd find out what he's going to be telling the students or talking to them about. But John, good to have you in studio.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, did you grow up in the church and the Christian college thing? Because it seems like you've got us pegged pretty well in terms of all the little idiosyncrasies that we
have. My father's a pastor. He started a church in Massachusetts after moving from North Carolina. So grew up in the church, literally, and then went to a Baptist college. And so I think the big thing for me is that I believe in the church. I love the church. I think it's the way the gospel shared. And so I'm not trying to pick on the church or mock the church. I think sometimes that happens. I'm a fan of it. I wasn't wounded by it. So I love to celebrate it. And for me, what great satire does is it takes a small issue and blows it up so large everybody can see it, and it creates a mirror. And then you stand beside the mirror and you say, hey, is this what love looks like? Are we okay as Christians that this is what we're doing? And as long as you'll stand beside it and make sure your reflection is in it too, you get to have a conversation. The minute you step behind it and just shine that on other people, you end up attacking. And so the only finger I like to point at is me and my idiosyncrasies, and there's plenty of those. And so it's been a fun ride so far.
Yeah. Well, and so how often do you update? I mean, do you write every day on Stuff Christians Like?
5 days a week. And okay. On Fridays, I do a guest post where somebody else gets to use the platform. I'm very cognizant of the fact that it's not mine. For whatever reason, God's given me temporary stewardship of this right now. And so I want to expose as many talented writers as I can to as many people as I can. So, but 5 days a week.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, let's give a few examples of some of the things that are in the book for those that aren't familiar, and just, you know, an example or two of them. And I guess I will come up with a couple of my favorites probably. But
one thing is wishing you had a shirt that said, I direct deposit my tithe, that you could wear on Sunday morning, because I know my row radius, my pew neighbors are judging me because I hot potato that offering basket. And you can't yell that. It's uncouth. Another would be not wanting to interlink digits at church when you have to hold your neighbor's hand during a prayer. Another would be prayer shot blocking, where somebody in your small group prays for something you know God's not going to answer. And so what happens is that Mary will pray, Lord, just grow my love with Tim, lead us towards marriage. And everybody knows in that small group, Tim is a punk. He's the worst person for Mary to be dating. So right after Mary prays, somebody will pray, Lord, please just give Mary insight and clarity so that she can, you know, hear what you're trying to tell her. And it's like right as Mary's prayer is floating up to heaven, her friend's prayer shot blocks it right back down to earth.
Yeah. And I noticed that in the prayer you said just a couple of times.
Oh, yeah. It's our favorite word. Sure. Just hear us, Lord. Just know us. And just Jesus.
I think I like the worship leader with the spangles on the pants.
Sure, we like to embellish.
And the bedhead.
Yeah, the deliberate
bedhead. You almost are almost there.
I'm not above that. I mean, my jeans are tighter than they were before I moved to Nashville. It's a very hipster city. People wear unnecessary scarves, which is when you wear a scarf with a short sleeve T-shirt, as if your neck is saying, I'm so cold I need a scarf, but my arms are saying it's too hot for sleeves. I'm pointing the finger at me. I have product in my hair right now. When you go on TV, you have to wear makeup. That couldn't be more hipster.
Yeah. Out of that, maybe helped you do some reflecting on why there does seem to be a whole generation that isn't so interested in church, though? I mean, there's David Kinnaman and others have done a lot of research on that. So, you know, there's a whole decade of kids, it seems like young adults, is that, you know, I'm just not really interested in this.
Sure. Well, I think in his book, You Lost Me, is great. Yeah. He's just brilliant. But I think it has, because what I experience is a lot of people that say, I forgot how fun and beautiful faith could be, and I read the blog, and it's really helped me get back into church. And I'd be a liar if I said I intended that. You know, I wanted to write a fun blog, and it's the consequences have been bigger than any degree of talent or coolness I possess. But I think that, you know, we've cared about things that other people haven't cared, or we haven't been the first to run to the fire with love in some cases. And part of that, I had a whole post about why are Christians such jerks? Because sometimes we really are, and I think part of it is that we're new. And we're learning, and we're human, and we're messing up. And so sometimes when somebody tells you you're a Christian, you assume they've been a Christian for 80 years, and you're going to see the end of a long walk. And more often than not, it's that they've just started this relationship, and man, they have some mistakes that they're still making. And so just to figure out, how do we be gracious to each other in that? How do we not attack each other in that? The church loses when Christians attack Christians. Nobody wants to be part of a faith that does that. And so I think there's a whole slew of that. I think they're fixable challenges, and I think that, you know, if we're honest, we can talk about them. I think one of the other things that plagued the church was the idea that our leaders believed, if I share my weakness, they'll never believe my strength. And so then you become this fake leader that only shares success moments, and you can't relate to that. And so I believe now this next generation understands, if I want to share my strengths, I have to get them to trust my weaknesses first.
So when you come to a college campus like Northwestern and have a chance to speak at chapel, do you just remind the students that, hey, that, you know, don't get caught up in the little sort of things that we do, but let's get the bigger picture?
Yeah, a lot of times they teach me. A lot of times I'm finding with Christian students, it's about helping them unlearn a God who isn't really true. And the God that maybe their pastor taught them existed, the God they thought existed. And that was certainly part of my story. I mean, the thing I run into all the time is at colleges, students will tell me, oh man, I've got a problem. I want to serve Jesus. I love Jesus, but I want to be a filmmaker. And what's happened is that our culture has placed the word but between who our God is and who our passions are. And the truth is, as you know it and I know it, is that sentence should say, I love God and I love filmmaking. And so part of my goal, you know, the goal of the site is to clear away the clutter of Christianity so that we can see the beauty of Christ. And the way that I do that is with satire. So when I come to a college, part of the first thing I have to do is kind of clear away that fake view of God, you know, where there's a lot of Christians that, reading the prodigal son story, if they were honest, would say, the party's too nice for me. You know, is there somebody's feet I could wash here? This is too nice for me, Lord. It's too lavish. And so helping people rediscover the beautiful God that we see in the Bible, if we'll read it.
Tell us a little bit more about your story. And encouragement from parents, or were they saying, hey, you know, follow your dreams, your passions, or
talk? No, I mean, my faith story is life fell apart about 7 years ago, just nuclear meltdown. You know, felt that I had to fix me with me, and I'd always been able to do that in some duct taped sort of way, but eventually some bad decisions were so big that I just couldn't do it anymore. And gave my life to Christ, and just changed my life. Certainly been a process. So as far as writing, I had a teacher in the third grade who laminated a book of my poetry, and it made me feel published. And that began kind of a lifelong love affair with writing. And so that had incredibly encouraging parents, had a dad who's a communicator. So grew up watching him communicate. So I feel like the things I get to do now are just a byproduct of standing on his shoulders, and a number of other people that have been above and beyond kind to me in ways they didn't need to be.
Yeah. But you weren't always a writer, though, right?
Mm. No, I spent my first 12 years in advertising. Yeah. And so had a great chance to learn at companies like Home Depot and Chick-fil-A and Bose and Staples. And so I always knew that I don't create art, I create action. And there's some amazing artists, and art has such a beautiful place in our conversation. But for me, I'm always curious about, what can I write or create that inspires action, that inspires change? And so that's what I try to do. And so I had a writer named Donald Miller who wrote this book, Blue Like Jazz, tell me one day, before I had ever really written much, and he said, your background in advertising will serve you well when you start to write books, because you know how to get somebody to do something. And so that's what I'm passionate about now.
Is that, should every writer have that that goal in mind and say it's not just about telling a story, but it's about getting somebody to do something?
No, I mean, I guess it depends on how you write and what you're trying to write. I mean, I think some people, it might be, I write fiction and I'm trying to get people to step into this scene I'm setting. It might be that I'm trying to, you know, help break down some walls between them and their dad. I mean, I think there's a million variations of it, but for me, you know, I'm a big believer that action beats intention. And a lot of times when you read a business book, when you read a self-help book, it's very high on words and things like, if you turn your attitude upside down, rainbows will fall on you and your dreams will be manifest in your hope. And you go, what does that mean? Like, those are just words. And so I try to, I don't like books like that. I don't like fluffy, doesn't change the world kind of stuff. And so I try to be that kind of writer that says, okay, and this is something Dave Ramsey's taught me over and over again, in that inspiration without instruction is useless. Because what happens, and you've had that experience where you go to a conference and it's amazing and you leave on an emotional just wave, but then Monday hits and Tuesday hits and Wednesday hits. So I try to not create inspiration without going, what does this mean in that person's life that really will help them change their life, not just get them excited in a room full of people and pretends Monday doesn't exist.
John Acuff is my guest. Jonathan is, he's the creator of StuffChristiansLike.net. You can read his blog regularly, StuffChristiansLike.net. Got a book by the same title, Stuff Christians Like. He's another book that we want to spend some time talking about in a few minutes. It's called Quitter, Closing the Gap Between Your Day Job and Your Dream Job. And we'll talk more with John Acuff in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem, and talking today with Jonathan Acuff. Jonathan is, well, as he describes himself, he used to be a serial quitter. He had 8 jobs in 8 years, hoping that the next one would be different. And from writing advertising for the Home Depot to branding for companies like Bose and Staples, he was no stranger to the cubicle, but found his way to writing and doing something that he was passionate about. In fact, he's now part of Dave Ramsey's team, and he's written a book we want to spend some time on for the next few minutes called Quitter, Closing the Gap Between Your Day Job and Your Dream Job. And, John, you've shared just a little bit about your story, but that 8 jobs in 8 years, that's a pretty tough track record.
Sure. Like, wives don't like that track record.
No.
They do not.
And, well, you probably didn't either, though, did you?
So, no, I mean, I wasn't happy, certainly, during that. I mean, I fell into a position a lot of people find themselves in the sense that I thought the next job would be the one that made me happy. And so I'd have a 6-month honeymoon period, and then I'd get bored, and I'd get bitter, and I'd demonize my boss and my job and say they don't understand me, they don't get me, I'm going to find a place that does. And then I'd change jobs, and the same problems from the last one would show up at the new one. And finally, I had to be honest and admit, you know, the common denominator in every bad job I ever had was me. And what am I going to do about that? You know, 10 years was enough. 10 years of donating my life to something I wasn't passionate about was enough. And so I started to work on that. And the crazy thing is, it'll sneak up on you. I gave a copy of my book, Quitter, to a woman on a plane, and she was in her maybe mid-70s, and she read some of it, and she said, hey, what do you do when all your excuses for not chasing your dream are gone? What do you do then? And it was profoundly sad, because for the first time in her life, she was reflecting on her life. And my fear is that we'll get to 80 or 90 and look back and realize we spent 70 years mortgaging our life to something that didn't matter.
Yeah. You moved around from job to job for a while, but we've heard statistics say that, you know, today's generation, that's not going to be uncommon, that they'll have a job for, 12 months, 18 months, and, you know, have, you know, 15 over a career.
I think
that a problem?
I think it is more common for job jumping. I think it depends on why you did it. I mean, if it's a vertical move and it's deliberate, that's one thing. But the reality is, most people, when they quit their job, they quit it like a prison escape. And by that, I mean, they don't look where they're going to land. They just focus on where they're going to leave. And that's a really great way to get in a worse job. And so what happens is you go, I hate this place, I hate this place, I hate this place, I just got to get out. And then you land in a job that's just as bad, if maybe not even worse. And so I'm a big believer that I'm all for you staying at your job if that's where you're supposed to be. I have a friend who's a wildly successful lawyer and does amazing work in Uganda. And he calls his law office fundraising, because it raises funds for the things he's passionate about. I would never encourage him to quit his job. But if you're somebody who hasn't done the work of trying to figure out what you're called to do, then maybe you need to. And I think there's ways you can do it that turns your previous job into a platform to jump from versus a prison to escape from, because nobody wins in a prison break.
So if it's a platform, so I mean, is that maybe the ideal that you have a job that enables you to do something else?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in the idea of the side passion. You see, what happens is the most powerful word you can have when it comes to dreaming is no. And by that, I mean, we like to think, oh, I'll get rid of my boss, I'll have all this free time. But when you quit your job without a plan, you get 1,000 new bosses. Their names are the water bill, the mortgage, the kids' school uniforms. And suddenly those things have a vote at the table, and they're not very forgiving. And so I'm a big believer that you've got to hang on to that word no. You've got to be able to say no to the wrong opportunities. And so for me, what that meant was I worked at Auto Trader, great company, IT department. I got offered a book deal. It was a horrible book deal. And if I had quit my job impulsively and I needed that money to pay for food, I might have had to say yes to that because I didn't have access to the word no. Because I still had a day job that were taking care of my bills, I was in a powerful position where I could say no. And so you see that especially with, let's take photographers. There's a lot of people right now that want to be professional photographers. And my friends will quit their day jobs. They'll become a photographer. In order to pay the bills, they have to say yes to every wedding. So what happens is at the end of the year, after 52 straight weekends of dealing with brides, they hate photos, they hate weddings, and they don't want to be a photographer anymore. So I'm a big believer in having a day job and practicing on the side. If you want to start a coffee shop, awesome. But if you tell me that, I'm going to say, have you ever worked at one? And if the answer is no, I'm going to say, well, let's figure that out. I'd much rather you learn on Starbucks dime, you know, two nights a week, and see if you even hate coffee. Maybe you hate retail hours. Don't mortgage your life the wrong way.
Well, I guess let's go back to the photography example. So does that mean that they weren't passionate about the photography? They just got into it the wrong way?
Well, they were passionate about photography. They just, the worst thing you can do is saddle your dream with all your bills and all your expectations all at once. It's not, here's the reality. When you start chasing a dream, your desire is always bigger than your talent. You have kind of this belief, oh, my desire is through the roof, but your talent isn't there yet. And so for me as a speaker, I wasn't a great speaker. I mean, my first speech was horrible, but I had to go through that to get better. And I didn't, if I had tied all my speaking to my salary and that was my whole, like, that's a different kind of thing. And I squeezed that dream a lot tighter than I might before. And so you've got to give yourself some space to get good, got to give yourself some time to practice and learn and grow and not rush that. We're so impatient.
So what does those strategies look like in terms of the giving yourself time to grow and get better?
So the like one of the greatest, easiest things you can do is what I call be selfish at 5 a.m. People tell me all the time, I don't have enough time to work on my dream. I don't have enough time. And we are busy. I don't know if you knew this stat. You and I work 163 more hours every year than people did 20 years ago. So what that means is you and I found an extra month of work every year. That's insane. And so we are busy. But what I found is that if I could get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, if I could get up at 5:30 and I could write for half an hour, just half an hour, the rest of my day job was so much better because I'd already creatively expressed myself. I didn't try to go force that at my day job. It was a slingshot that shot me into the day. And that was fun. And so if you can figure out how to carve your time up, and the reality is if you can't get up half an hour earlier to work on your dream, you got the wrong dream. If you won't pay that price, oh man, you're going to hate the later prices. Because the dream, you know, you work harder at something you love than at something you like. I get up earlier now that I'm doing this than I ever did at my day job. If you want to coast through life, keep your day job. But if you want to live a passionate, loud, colorful life, chase a dream job. And so one of the first things you can do is go, okay, I'm going to rescue 30 minutes a day. And the big thing is the end of the day is not the same as the beginning of the day. And by that, I mean, scientists have done studies. There's a great book called The Power of Habit where they talk about this. And basically what they've figured out is that discipline and willpower are finite. We have a resource of that that can be exhausted. And so they did this amazing test. They brought people in. They said, hey, there's two different groups. The first group, they said, okay, there's a big pile of warm chocolate chip cookies. Your job is to eat those. Don't touch the radishes. There were a pile of raw radishes. So they ate the chocolate chip cookies. What a great test. Second group comes in. They do the reverse. They say, you got to eat these radishes. Don't touch the cookies. So then at the end of the day, they said, hey, we're going to run the numbers. Here's a quiz we want you to try to solve while we run the numbers. The quiz didn't have an answer. Their goal was to see how long will these people try to figure out the quiz before they quit. So what they found was the people that had eaten the chocolate chip cookies tried for 19 minutes. The people that had eaten the radishes tried for 9. And what happened was they had already exhausted their willpower. They were tired from trying that. So they've done all these studies about executives that have affairs at night, that have just been a huge day on the road. And here's the, is that an excuse? By no means. But it's also the reality of why it's harder to run after your work. It's harder to do things that matter to you at 8 o'clock at night, at 9 o'clock at night. So I'm a big believer in the power of doing something in the morning. And so, you know, and the other truth is that according to Nielsen, the rating studies, the average American watches 35 hours of TV a week. So if you want 10 hours of free time to work on your dream, watch 10 hours less. And I'm not being one of those people that goes, I don't even own a TV. I don't have cable. Like, I don't like that person. It's annoying. So pious. I'm just saying only watch one day a week. You're still watching 4 hours of TV a day. So if you can't show me where you're giving your dream time, you don't have a dream.
I was thinking, too, it's probably important that we not be doing our dream on our day job.
No. Yeah. That's a big temptation, is to steal from your day job. And guess what they didn't hire you to do? To work your dream job. I don't care if you're bored. You find things to keep you active. The reality is this. One of the big lessons for me was you can't be lazy at your day job for 40 hours a week and then think you'll flip this magic hustle switch on the weekend. How you work during the day is how you work at night. You can't be a bad employee and a good dreamer. So once you can start to see that connection, you can really do stuff. So for me, at one of my jobs, I was not busy. And the temptation there was, well, I'll write my blog. I'll be on Twitter. And so instead, I found leadership opportunities. This job had a bunch of free leadership training. So I took that because I knew later on down the road I might need that. So there's ways to do that. But you've got to be faithful to your employer.
Yeah. Is this message resonate differently with someone who's 25 versus 45 or 65?
Yeah, I've been really surprised. I mean, we do this thing called the Quitter Conference. It's a two-day figure-out-your-dream experience, and the demographic is all over the place. We'll have people that will come and say, I worked at a steel mill for 30 years. I'm ready to do something different. We'll have 22-year-olds that go, I don't want to jump to the wrong job. What I would say, though, is there's definitely a different message for college students than there is for somebody who's been in that cubicle for 25 years. Or has been in it for 5 years or 10 years, because there is a different level of stuckness. When you're in college, you're still kind of in that warm glow of anything's possible. So sometimes, you know, if you're 25 or 35, I have to first give you permission to mourn the years you've already lost and kind of work through that. I mean, I got an email from a college student or a college grad. He said, I've been out of dental school for 2 years. I knew when I was in dental school, I didn't want to be a dentist, but there's too much momentum, too many people to disappoint. So I kept going. Now I have $200,000 in debt, and the only way to get out of it is to keep being a dentist. So that person, I need to share a different type of hope with them than I do a 21-year-old who I might share the similar principles, but from a different angle, because they don't have that hurt to unpack first before they can get to the dream. They're closer to it. And I can say, hey, okay, let's make the right decisions. Let's give, you know, that 21-year-old, you know what they need? They need grace to accept that they might not land in their dream job right out of school. I had a 22-year-old tell me she feels like she's part of generation expectation. The media told her she'd have a dream job, dream husband, dream car, dream Kardashian life right out of college, and it hasn't happened. And so what I tell her is different than what I tell the 42-year-old stay-at-home mom who wants to do something.
John Acuff's my guest, and we're talking about Quitter, closing the gap between your day job and your dream job. And we've got more to come here in just a moment. We're going to talk about developing and finding that dream as we continue here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we're connecting today with John Acuff. We've had John on in the past, and we're excited to have him in studio. He's actually on the campus of Northwestern College talking with the students and giving some good encouragement to them. And all of us are benefiting by some of his wisdom, which you can find in his great book called Quitter, Closing the Gap Between Your Day Job and Your Dream Job. John works, he's part of the team with Dave Ramsey now, and has had a number of jobs, and writes on a daily blog called StuffChristiansLike.net. I encourage you to check that out as well. And we'll talk a little bit more about resources through Quitter. But John, then we talked a little bit about the dream and the passion. Those words get kind of thrown around a lot sometimes. What's the step to finding it? Because everybody says in the kind of the career search, well, you got to sit down and figure out what you're passionate about. And like, well, how do we actually do that?
We've really messed that up culturally. A lot of us believe a few very, very definitive lies about purpose. We believe you'll have one. You'll know it by 22. Everybody else knows theirs already. It'll be perfect. It'll change everything. Everything will change, and you should wait for it to show up. I'm a big believer that purpose is attracted to motion, that purpose finds you in the middle of movement. So if you've waited to find your purpose, the wait's over. You gave it a fair shot. Just get going. Get started. And sometimes we're afraid to go down the wrong path. So what I'll find is people say, I've got five passions. I don't know where to start, so I won't start anywhere. And so I'm a big believer in just start on the first one. And maybe the third one is what will really drive home, but you need to work through the first and second to be even better at the third by the time you get there. And the other thing is that it's kind of ludicrous to tell an 18-year-old you'll be able to pick a major that you'll do for the next 50 years. Your brain isn't physically formed until your mid-20s, but we expect an 18-year-old to have that figured out. And then you and I know. You and I have talked to successful 70-year-olds, and you know what they all have in common? Not a one of them would say, you know, at 22, I knew exactly where this life was going to go. I'm a big believer, and I wrote a new book about this idea that the only line you control is the starting line. You have no control over the finish line. God is going to take you places you can't even fathom, but you've got to start. So if you've got a problem with the man in the mirror, you need to deal with that.
But as you said, you're maybe working through those if you have multiple passions. So it's maybe the question is, how long do we stay at one till we decide, well, it's number three was really the passion, but you know, did I quit too soon on one or two?
Well, there's a number of things I'd say. One is practice it. There's a great way to figure out if the dream is really what you're supposed to do, and that's to practice it. And so for me, when I decided, hey, maybe I want to be a public speaker, I didn't quit my job to become a public speaker. I spoke for a few times for free at a rehab center. Because for me, talk about people who need hope, like the rehab center. I had a friend who spoke for a number of times at an old age home. So I'd always go, is there a way to practice it? I had a guy, amazing, he owned a car company. He picked up people for the airport and taxi service. And he had a bad taxi experience and thought, I could do better than that. And so he got hired in a part-time job at a taxi service and learned how to do it. And then he did it on his own. So I'd say, practice it. Is there a part-time job? And then the big thing, and sometimes I'll go speak somewhere and people try to stump me in the Q&A and they'll go, hey, if everybody, you know, follows their dream job, who's going to pick up my garbage? And so we kind of think that the job title is the dream. But the reality is what it's all about is figuring out what your core is. Because once you figure out the core, the job is just an execution. There's 1,000 jobs you can have. So for me, once I realized I like to share ideas, the thing I feel called to do is share ideas. And my big thing is I jumpstart people who feel stuck. I'm not a good 10 years walk you through this. I'm a great jumpstart. And the reason I help people who feel stuck is because I believe the unstuck are unstoppable. And so once I figured that core out, I could be a radio host, I could write a book, I could have a blog, I could go back to school and become a counselor and share ideas one-on-one. Suddenly at 1,000 job openings. And so what happens most of the time is we look for that perfect job first without understanding our heart. And so I had a great example that I had to call up Apple customer service for an hour and a half to fix the cloud. And I asked the girl there, I said, hey, what's your job like? And I thought she'd say, it's the worst, because customer call center, take your worst phone call this week and multiply it by 40 hours. Nobody calls up and goes, you know what? Things are working really well. Just wanted to thank you. Just thank you so much. Nobody calls that. And so I said, what's your job like? And she said, I love it. And as a guy like me, I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, there's two things I feel called to do. Help people solve problems and learn new things. She said, I get to do that all day. What a gift. And so for her, she had realized that. So as I encourage people to figure out their passion, that's a big part of it. The other part of it, it's not an act of discovery. It's an act of recovery. Most times it's an act of rescuing something that you loved and you lost versus having this eureka moment. Most of us have experienced some joy of something we love doing by the time we're 18, but along the way we dropped it. And sometimes it's because somebody who mattered to us told us it didn't matter. Somebody said, how could you make money doing that? That's silly. That's dumb. You shouldn't do that. And so figuring out what you're called to do usually isn't a first date. It's a reunion.
So is there a point where we also need to maybe get a new perspective on the work that we have to do to say, well, maybe actually, you know, I like learning new things. So dealing with crabby customers is not all bad. I mean, do we just have to change our perspective sometimes?
Some of that is. I mean, part of it is seeing the relationship between where you are and where you want to be. And so for me, once I learned I like to share ideas with people, I felt like God kind of said, hey, guess where people are? They're at your day job. You're surrounded by humans. Like, stop daydreaming about these people you're going to help someday and help the ones that are in your current day. So I'm a big believer in that there are aspects of your dream job already present in your day job if you'll look at them with the right attitude. And so once I did that, suddenly it wasn't Mark, the annoying guy in the cubicle next to me. It was Mark, the guy going on his third divorce. And how dare I dream about writing books about hope? Well, I ignored Mark's hurt. And so, yeah, I'm a complete believer in figure out how you can do that there. And then, again, that's another part of it. Maybe you learn you weren't called to do that, but learn it there versus I've sold everything. I've kind of done the Cortez light the ships on fire. I can't return kind of thing. That's what we like to be dramatic. And then we like to blame it on God. We love to throw God under the bus and go, I'm going to step out in faith. And you know what? That's Christian code for no plans, as if God hates plans. And a friend told me that he thinks that some Christians like to skydive out of the plane, and God turns back and goes, whoa, why'd you red bullet? Like, I was going to land the plane. Like, I didn't tell you to do that. And so just this idea of what a faithful God we have, and he's not opposed to planning. He's not opposed to us being deliberate and thoughtful.
Well, and that probably is a pretty important responsibility too, as a husband, if you're married.
Sure.
I mean, that your spouse would appreciate the plan.
Wives,
right?
Like stability. Yeah. Go figure. Like, she enjoys security and like food.
Yeah. So planning is probably not a bad thing.
No, I think it's a great thing. And I think I wouldn't say you have to, you know, it's a pendulum. You don't need to have the perfect plan before you start. You know, start. Yeah. Passion will always lead to a plan. A plan will never lead to passion. So the best entrepreneurs, the most successful people will say, I saw something that was broken in the world and I threw my body at it. And here's what happened. I saw an opportunity that nobody else saw and here's what happened. They never say, I had a 42-step plan and then I worked that and by step 32, passion showed up. No. Passion has to be your fuel. Fame can't be your fuel. Money can't be your fuel. Accomplishment can't be your fuel. All of those will run out. It has to be your heart.
Well, we're talking about spouses. Maybe say a word about spouses, parents, you know, just concerned friends. How do we encourage someone to pursue their passion, their dream, and have a plan at the same time?
Well, the first thing I'd say is dreaming is a great team sport. I'm a big believer in a shared dream. The worst place you can put your spouse is on the opposite side of your dream, because what happens is the harder you push into the dream, the further you push them away. And you get into fights where you say things like, don't you want my dream to work? Like, why? Or even worse, Christians will take God's side. They'll go, why are you fighting this thing God told me to do? And it's like, oh, great. So my wife, God's on my side. You must be with Satan. Like, you know, good luck with that. And so I heard a pastor, a guy named John Woodall, brilliant guy in Atlanta, works for North Point Community Church. He said, in every marriage, there's two types of people. There's how people and wow people. And the wow person comes and goes, I've got an idea. I've got a dream. I'm going, And the how person goes, well, how will we make money with that? How will we pay the bills? How will we have health insurance? And they're asking out of love, but in that moment, the wow person feels attacked. And so they stop talking about that, and they keep butting heads. And it's not that the wow person's dreams go away. They just go somewhere else. And that's a really dangerous place for a marriage. And we see, you know, one out of every third divorces mentions Facebook in the divorce filings. And so what happens is we see emotional affairs where somebody goes, oh, they get me. They listen to my dreams. And so my wife and I, we were headed down that path where I was the wow person, she was the how person. So what we learned to do is two pretty simple things. One, I have a wow disclaimer. I say to Jenny, hey, I'm not thinking about quitting my job tomorrow. I'm not looking to mortgage the house. I just want to dream, and you're my person. So let's dream together. And so we'll talk about that. So I give her a wow disclaimer, and then she gives me 2 weeks of wow grace. So for 2 weeks, she says, wow, that's awesome. Wow. And doesn't ask how questions, because she knows if I'm still talking about that idea 2 weeks later, maybe it really matters. But she also knows the reality is 10 minutes after I say it, I probably will forget it and I will have moved on. And so I think you've got to really focus on that. And our culture does not like the idea of dreaming in the context of a relationship. There's a great John Mayer song where he talks about how there's this guy who builds a submarine in his basement. And it said, when you're done with this world, you create your new one. And he sails to Tokyo and woo, dreams. And then you hear the lyrics and it says, his wife told his kids he was crazy. So our culture is okay with you saying, hey, kids, I got a dream. And guess what? It's to escape you. Like, that guy's an absentee, horrible father. And so I'm a big believer that dreaming isn't just one size where it's okay to dream means you get a machete and a goatee and you go to Ecuador. Like, I think as a dad, you can dream. As a husband, you can dream. As a family, you can dream. And I think that responsibility amplifies dreams. It doesn't destroy them.
Do you have a time when you dream, or a setting or a situation? You said, you know, your wife gives you a couple weeks of grace. What does the dream time look like for you?
Well, part of it is I'll take note cards, single note cards, and I'll write down ideas on each note card, one idea in a note card, and I'll throw them up on a pin board. And the reason I like note cards versus a whiteboard is I can move them around. And so, yeah, I'll start to do that and just gather ideas. The problem is most of us self-edit before things even hit the paper. We have such this sense of doubt and fear that before an idea even gets out on paper, we edit it and don't let it see the light of day. So I teach this creativity class, and I really encourage people, you got to remember there's two things. There's quantity and quality. When you start dreaming, it's about quantity. Your only job is to get as many ideas. Don't self-edit. Later, you can worry about quality. What I say is when I'm feeling doubtful, I'll go, later John's going to be awesome. He's in charge of awesome. I'm just in charge of volume. So I'll create and create and create. And then later, John, a day later, a week later, man, he has to sort through some nonsense. But guess what? The nonsense is often hidden on the bottom of the, you know, the great stuff. So that's part of my process.
John Acuff's my guest. We're talking about Quitter, closing the gap between your day job and your dream job. And we're going to talk more about the writings and the work of John Acuff in just a moment here as we continue on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and glad to have in studio today Jonathan Acuff. He's creator of StuffChristiansLike.net, and he's written the book Stuff Christians Like. He's also written Gazelles, Baby Steps, and 37 Other Things. Dave Ramsey taught me about debt. We'll talk about that in a moment as well. Quitter, closing the gap between your day job and your dream job, and spending some time on that. And is there a new one that's just you're coming
out?
Yeah,
I've got a new book coming out in the spring.
Okay, I'll look forward to that. I want to pick up on something. You talked about doubt and fear, kind of how that can waylay us. Is that something that we get from the outside, or does that come from inside?
Well, I think we get it from all angles, but one thing in the new book that was a challenge for me, a friend of mine asked me one day, he said, hey, what do your voices tell you? And that's a weird question. And so I said, what do you mean? I mean, it just is. Yeah. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I've asked 1,000 people that question, and nobody has a positive internal voice. Nobody's internal voice says, you sure are skinny enough. You sure are the best one to host that show. That opportunity is going to work out. You're almost overqualified for that. Instead, we have these negative voices of doubt. And the real challenge is we believe them to be friends when they're actually foes. So, for instance, when I started to write Quitter, which is a business book, I heard a voice say, who are you to write a business book? Your first book wasn't a real book. It was based on a blog. It's illustrated. There's a unicorn in that book. You're not a writer. People keep that book in their bathroom. And so I felt this great sense of doubt and dread about that. And so one of the things that every leader hears when they start something new is, who are you to do that? Who are you to think you can do that, that you're smart enough and talented enough? And so one of the things I encourage people to do is write them down. Write them down so you can see the absurdity of them and refute them with truth. So one morning at 7:27 a.m. on a Monday, and I hear this voice say, you're behind. You're already behind. If you could just get ahead, you could rest. You know, the week's already past you. And I wrote that down. I could see, wow, it's 7:27 on a Monday morning. I couldn't have more week if I wanted to. I'm behind what? And get ahead of what? It's absurd. And the problem is fear is schizophrenic. It tries to argue both sides of the argument so that you have no room to stand. So fear will say, you should be afraid of failure. And then at the other stroke, it'll say, you should be afraid of success too. And then you go, well, where would I possibly stand? Or it'll tell you, do it later or do it all right now perfectly. And you go, well, that, like, one of those has to be a lie. And so my favorite thing in the last year is at the Quitter conference, I started to ask people, what do your voices tell you? And the tenor of the room changes. And so last time I did it, I asked the room, I said, hey, what do your voices tell you? And people say things like, you know, everybody's going to laugh, you're not talented. And a woman said, my voice says I'm too old. And right next to her, somebody said, my voice says I'm too young. And so I just stopped and said, they both can't be right. They both, you know, fear will never tell you this is the best time to chase your dream. Fear will never tell you you've regretted enough. If you ask fear, have I regretted that mistake enough? The answer is never. You know what? You have. It's time for us to move on. Time to head into hope. No. And so I think they come from the outside. I think they come from the inside. And the reality is fear only gets loud when you do things that matter. If you want to be average, if you want to be common, if you want to be ordinary, if you want to rock vanilla right into the grave, go for it. Fear will give you a free pass. But if you dare to stand up, that's when fear gets loud.
There should be some realism there, though, shouldn't there? I mean, it may be that you aren't really talented enough. I mean, that, you know, you and I are probably not going to be NBA players, I'm thinking.
Yeah. So, I'm not going to be in the NFL. Yeah. No, I think it's what I look at it kind of like the Stockdale paradox. Stockdale was a gentleman who was in a POW camp for years, brutal, brutal Vietnamese POW camp. And he told Jim Collins in the book Good to Great, Jim Collins said, who didn't survive? And he said, the optimists. And that kind of took Jim Collins back. And he said, what do you mean? He said, well, the optimists were the ones who said, by Christmas we'll be out. And then they weren't. By Easter we'll be out. And then they weren't. And he said they died of a broken heart. And so what Stockdale says is you have to be, you know, honest about your present circumstances and hopeful. And so the way I frame that in my own life is you have to be brutally realistic about your current circumstances and wildly unrealistic about your future. Where we get it wrong, and you just pointed this out, is we're usually wildly unrealistic about our present and our future. So I'll have people tell me, I'm going to pretend like I don't have $80,000 in student loans. I'm just going to dream. Oh. And then those things don't go away because you magically dream. Like they hurt you. And so I'm a big fan, and yeah, there is realism there. And sometimes it's about figuring out where your talent is. I think everybody's talented. I don't think they're all talented at the same thing. And the other thing is that I believe if you can figure out your core, the accomplishment becomes a consequence. It becomes gravy of it. And I had a band that I saw at Catalyst, played to 13,000 people, amazing band called Sarin. They're out of Texas. And then I saw them at a house show in somebody's living room randomly. And I thought, they're going to play to 3 or 4. And they played at a 10. And what I realized there is that you should always play to the size of your heart, not the size of your crowd. And so when you figure out what you're called to do, man, the crowd doesn't get to determine that. And so, I'm a big believer. I mean, that's probably one of the knocks against me is that some motivational folks would tell me I'm not dreamy enough or I don't, you know, reach for the stars enough. But I just can't do that knowing how fun, like how I could turn my present into a slingshot, into a catapult if I look at it the right way versus going, I'm going to pretend that I don't have bills or I don't have family responsibilities or commitments. So yeah, I'm a very much, how do we knock out the now, but also dream about tomorrow?
You've been on Dave Ramsey's team for a number of years. Talk a little bit about how maybe you've learned from Dave or observed in his life some principles that you've been able to apply.
So. Oh, it's been like a PhD in leadership. I mean, one of my favorites was 72 hours before he released his last book, Entre Leadership. And Dave doesn't casually write books. This was his first book in 7 years. And they had a 30-city tour planned. And there was a bus. And there was, I mean, it was huge. And he called me to his office and told me he had a problem. And so I said, okay, you know, what's the problem? And he said, well, at each of these book signings, we'll have 2,000 people. And I won't be able to hear everybody's story as much as I'd want to. And because if I do listen to the first 10 stories, I won't get to 1,000 people at the back of the line. So how do I make sure that the mom in Ohio, the dad in Nebraska knows that this is why we do this, for their story, for their hope? How do I make sure they know that and still serve everybody in the line? And to me, that was such a great reminder of that's what it's about. I've met leaders and you've met leaders that the higher they go up the ladder, the further they get away from real people. I've had conversations where the leader would have been saying, how do I get these yahoos through the line fast enough? And here's Dave saying the opposite. And what I realized was Dave's able to do that. He's able to stay connected to the end user, to the individual, because 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, when they call in to the radio show, they're talking to Dave. He's hearing the single mom who became a single mom because her husband just died of cancer at 32. And so he's still connected to people. And so that was a great lesson for me as a would-be leader, as a young leader, hopefully, of going, how do you always make sure you keep your eyes on the prize about serving people and make sure that you never get too big for your britches and you never lose sight of that? So things like that, that again, Dave didn't do that for the press. He didn't do it for the story. He didn't do it because hopefully one day John would share that on the air. He did it because it was the right thing to do. And so for me, that kind of thing is really powerful. And my hope is that I'll always have a humble enough heart to see those lessons and never feel like I'm beyond those.
Yeah. What do you do to, maybe just to continue to grow personally and professionally? I mean, you talked about you obviously you surround yourself with great people, but are there some tips, some things that you would recommend for all of us to keep, as Covey talked about, sharpening the saw?
Sure. I mean, you're right. The people one's a good point. I try to keep people in my life that love me enough to tell me things I might not like to hear. And that, you know, I'm a big believer in mirror friends that will mirror the truth to you. And might tell you something, you know, and that's the challenge. You surround yourself with yes people, and even a good pastor gets lost pretty quickly. So that's one of them. My wife and I, you know, very deliberate about spending time together, cell phone free time. I mean, for me, that's one of the things I try to do is balance out my online time versus kind of my 3D time.
Because you're a writer online all the time, so it'd be just easy to just sort of, you know.
Yeah, and we're getting sucked into that. There's been all these studies about, you know, there's a book called The Shallows about what the internet is doing to our brain from a physical perspective, and they've just did a study where kids can't read a whole page of copy anymore. And if you're not scared of that, you're not paying attention. And a Duke University professor said she can no longer get her students to read whole books, and she's an English professor. And so I try to stay on top of current topics. I try to exercise. I think that, you know, it is a balance. You don't want to be an amazing leader that you know, loses their position because they have heart trouble, you know. And so trying to see that there's a relationship. I'm a big believer in that we're one person. I mean, that's why it's crazy to me that people are confused why Tiger Woods isn't amazing at golf, as if maybe there's golf Tiger and there's business Tiger and there's husband Tiger and father Tiger, and that he could mess up parts of those, you know. But nobody ever says, hey, don't drink that water. The top is poisoned. They say, don't drink that whole water. The whole thing's bad. If you've got a fire in the basement, the attic's going to get impacted. So I try to be, you know, cognizant of that. And, you know, I try to read a bunch, try to, you know, stay connected to the word. And try, you know, my big thing is that I think we're just called to pour out the stuff that's poured into us. And the times when I don't do that and I'm on vapors, I can tell, people around me can tell.
Yeah. Well, you have an opportunity to impact some students here on campus. And is there, you know, without giving away the speech, is there one nugget that you want to make sure that they take away when you talk to them?
Well, I think I'm a big believer that this is one of the greatest times in the world to change the world. And there's three things that caused me to believe that. One, retirement is dead. The boomer generation is realizing the finish lines they are promised no longer exist. The market's going to recover. The ideals won't. And so you can see that right now there's what they're calling an encore career, that boomers are having to have an encore career. And they believe that retirement will go up to 80, and stretch. And, you know, the largest growth in entrepreneurs last year was between 55 years old and 64. So that's the first thing, is there's a huge generation reentering the market. They have to be 20 again, so to speak. The second thing is anyone can play. 10 years ago, we were told technology got rid of all gatekeepers. It didn't. Create a new one. Software developers, engineers. Now, moms can make millions on Facebook. You know, teens are building platforms. Anyone can play. The technology is available in a way it never was before. A friend of mine sold a Facebook page. You know, people are selling online properties with no hard costs. And the third is that hope is boss. And by that, I mean this generation wants to change the world now. Do you know how many people in my college graduating class built wells in Africa? Zero. Do you know how many wore Toms? Zero. Do you know how many cared about a hoodie purchase going to charity? Zero. But this generation's different. And so, I mean, you probably remember the book. Bob Buford wrote a great book called Halftime, and essentially said to the boomers, you're 45, spent the first 20 years of your life on success. Let's spend the next 20 on significance. If you and I had a 21-year-old come in here and we said, hey, in 20 years, you'll get to change the world, they'd laugh. And so what's happening is you got a whole generation pushing down, a whole generation pushing up, and the tools in the middle to actually do it. So if I could leave the students with one thing, it'd be, yeah, I know the stats sometimes are scary, unemployment, job market shrinking, but wow, this is a great time if you're willing to hustle to be in the job market.
John, what's the best way to read more about you and find out about Quitter and the latest writings and books and stuff?
Sure. So. Well, I do a business motivational blog, johnacuff.com, J-O-N-A-C as in cat, U, F as in Frank, F as in Frank.com. That's my Twitter name too, at John Acuff. And my books are available on, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all over the place. And so, you know, it's always fun to connect with people. I'm obviously a huge fan of social media. It's part of why I get to be here. So,
hey, thanks for carving out a little time to spend with me today. And I think our listeners are going to be really encouraged and hopefully dream big and let that passion take them forward.
Well, thanks. I had a blast today.
You're listening to Connecting Faith, John Acuff. My guest, check him out, johnacuff.com.